come on my podcast. I'm like, nah, I'm not doing any anymore.
Well, here we go. I'm the lucky guy.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
You know,
I'll tell you what I'd do.
It's just a real nigga shit. You real nigga.
Two chicks at the same time, man.
This beat is so, so rich.
Episode 22, Bean Shooter Podcast. Today we have a special guest, a friend of mine, Ken Rideout.
Boom.
Kenny hails from Somerville originally. Lives in Nashville now.
Yep.
Before that, you were in, where in California? Venice? Where were you?
I started in New York with stops in London and Hong Kong, and then I lived in LA for 5 years, and I've been in Nashville for two.
Awesome. Place in, the place in California right on the ocean.
Oh, wow. Pacific Palisades.
Yeah, Pacific Palisades, you know. Ken used to, you know, leave me the keys to watch the house once in a while, and we used to rip it up there. But I met Kenny, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. I might have met him a long time ago, actually, in Billerica House of Correction, but memory's a little foggy. But I met Mickey, Kenny, I was with Mickey Ward at the Boxing Hall of Fame. And people might know Kenny by... you know, a multitude of things. He's a world-class runner, world-class athlete, not just a runner. He's done a lot. We'll get into that, whatever that Ironman thing was in Mongolia, whatever the hell it was. But he does a podcast with Teddy Atlas, who actually trained a friend of mine, Michael Mora, and was in Michael's corner when he beat Holyfield to become the heavyweight champion of the world. And, there's some great moments with Teddy yelling at him in the corner, just like when he was getting Timothy Bradley fired up. You know, I met Timmy Bradley last year in New York also. And when I met Kenny, he had Mickey on the podcast with him and Teddy. And I almost sat in with it, but Dickie, you know, me and Dickie ended up going somewhere, and I didn't. And ever since then, me and Kenny have talked a lot and became pretty good friends. And, you know, I've been following him and you know, we'll get into it. It's amazing. We'll start out, you know, where you came from, basically, you know, because it's an amazing journey from where you grew up, where you came from, and where you are now.
Yeah, that's probably fair assessment. I grew up in Somerville. I played football and hockey at Somerville High School. The week after I graduated high school, I started working as a guard at the Billerica House of Corrections, cracking heads, keeping the place in order. You know how I did it, Mike. Yeah. And I worked with, interestingly enough, I worked with Mickey Ward there. He was a guard there too. I was always surprised they didn't put that part in the movie, The Fighter. But Dickie was an inmate at the time. But my brother would eventually end up as an inmate there, and my stepfather had previously done time there. And yeah, I worked my way through Framingham State, which is, for those who don't know, the Harvard of Framingham, Mass. When I got out of Framingham, I played football and hockey at Framingham State. And then when I got out, I moved to New York. And, you know, as soon as I got there, I was working in a pharmaceutical sales job. But I saw all these young guys like my age working in finance and making huge money. And I was like, man, these guys are dweebs. If these guys are doing this, why can't I? You know, but at the time, if you told me to go to New York and work in finance and banking, I would have said, well, why stop there? Why don't I go be an astronaut? It just seemed so foreign to me. I didn't know anyone that did that. But long story short, I did it, had a long, successful, by my measure, career in finance with, like I said, with stops in London and Hong Kong. But along the way, in the early parts of my career, when I started to have some financial success, the stress and pressure, which I know to a lot of people might sound crazy now, was getting to me, and I was suffering from like an imposter syndrome or fraud complex, because all the kids I was working with were Ivy League kids, fancy degrees. I didn't know anything from like how to dress. I didn't know anything about finance. So I was just learning on the fly. And after a year or two there, I had a minor ankle surgery and got prescribed some Percocets. And from there, I was whacked on opioids for 10 straight years, 24/7. And Yeah, when I got to get sober, I started running. And by running, I just started running 10 miles a day, every day. And we'll talk more about specifics. But then I would eventually, last year, I won the age group 50 and over world championships at the Chicago Marathon. I ran 2:29 marathon, 5:39 per mile, 26 miles.
Unbelievable.
And prior to getting into running, I did some Ironman stuff. I did the Ironman in Hawaii 3 times. But we can get into more of the specifics. And I also won a race in Mongolia called the Gobi March last June at 52. I had that no experience.
Crazy. That was crazy.
Yeah,
that
it was crazy. It was a six-day race, self-supported, meaning you had to carry all your own food, everything except water, and over 155 miles. I had no experience running with a backpack, no camping experience. I grew up in Somerville. Like we didn't camp. I didn't have any outdoor skills, but I just picked it up as quickly as I could when I got to Mongolia, and I end up winning by like 90 minutes. And over the last couple of years, I've been described by the Wall Street Journal and New York Times as the best marathon runner over 50, which sounds crazy for me to even say, but I did it.
Yeah. I mean, I think your career would be successful by anyone's measure, not just your own. Talking about fraud, I never heard fraud complex before. I mean, I know a few people who suffer from fraud complex, but I've never heard it like that. But yeah, going, it's a testament to yourself that, you know, I think, you know, growing up, you know, how you grew up and being around everybody, it just goes to show you. I mean, I like to think, I mean, you know, I was never too studious, but, you know, I did a lot of reading, especially in jail and stuff. But I like to think I could hold my own in a conversation, whether I'm with, you know, killers or I'm with doctors. I think, you know, I can pretty much, you know, hold my own and just bullshit with anybody, basically. But, what you did, it's nothing short of amazing. And, that Mongolia race, you know, blew me away. And I know Joe Rogan talked about it on his podcast about you and a couple of things. And I'm like, holy shit, you know, and then I start seeing you. You got Reebok now.
Yep.
On your corner. You're starting to, you're a hustler. No matter, you know.
That's a good description.
Yeah, you're a hustler, whether it's in finance, whatever it is, you know, and it's awesome that, you know, and this ain't a shot at anybody who's a prison guard or anything, but you said this ain't for me.
No. So I was there for a week and I was like, nah, this is not the life I want. It's not for me. Like you said, it's good for anyone else who enjoys it and likes doing it. But
it was a lot of fun back then,
though. That was the biggest kick in the ass I needed. And I was like, man, I got to start focusing on my grades. And I think if there's any takeaway from what has happened to me and what I've been able to do, it's that, like, I don't have any special skills, right? I'm like 5'10", 165 pounds. I don't have any, I'm not a great athlete. No Division I schools were looking for me. I basically just, everything that I have came from hard work, and all of the things that I've been able to do are all within my control. So with the running, I mean, I just trained more than anyone. The only thing I'm doing that a lot of great runners aren't doing is trying. I just outworked and out-hustled a lot of people. And, that's the kind of message that I'm trying to spread with some of the media that I've done recently. And I'm writing a book. And that's what I hope the main takeaway is, that anyone can do what I've done. I have nothing special other than my mindset. And that's within all of our control.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you put your mind to it, you can do it. You know, you've been telling me to stop eating donuts for a year, and I'm getting there. I go on these spurts where I'm like, I'm real good. I'll go to the gym every day for 2 months, and I'm eating great, you know? And then I'm like, you're calling me up, like, what are you doing, smashing a whole pizza pie to your face tonight, Mike? You know what I mean? So I try to lock in. I get locked in, and I do good for a while, and then I get out of the gym, and it takes, you know, I'm a routine guy like yep, anyone else, right? And I get into it, and I'm all in, and then I don't go to the gym for a week, and I eat one pizza, and I eat a donut, and it's just like the addiction thing, right? Next thing you know, it's, you know, 11:30 at night, like last night, and I'm at Modern Pastry smashing 3 cannolis, you know, trying to order espressos, and they're like, yeah, it's fucking midnight, buddy. No one's ordering espressos. But yeah, you put your mind to it, and, you know, just like anything else, right, it's easy to let yourself go, and it's so easy to procrastinate and put things off, and it's not as easy to to get up every morning and do road work? Like every day you run?
I've run every day for about 5 years. So in the last 2 years, I ran 4,000 miles each year, which is just over 11 miles a day. And no matter what the conditions, if I'm skiing with the kids, I'm running in the morning before we go skiing. It's just, there's just no excuses. I mean, you know, if, when you start to experience a little bit of success as a result of the processes you put in place, you don't start deviating and creating new processes to make it easier on yourself. When it works, you just stick with the program. I mean, you know, look at what you've been able to do with your own life. It's like that shit doesn't happen by accident, but like I said earlier, everything is within your control if you really want to do it. I'm sure when you were in Walpole, they were like, if someone told you you were going to get out and have your own successful business and have the personality and the following you have on social media, you would have thought they were crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the one thing I enjoy about following your profile on Instagram is that, you know, there's some crazy shit on there, obviously, that I'm like, dude, you better take that down. But it just is, it serves as a reminder of like, yo, if this guy could turn it around from where he was to where he is now, like anyone can do this. And it doesn't have to be running and it doesn't have to be roofing, but it does have to be working towards something. You have to find something that you're passionate about and be the best at it. Playing the guitar, being a videographer, whatever you do, the guy who works the most, the hardest, that's going to be the guy who's the best, and that's the guy who's going to be the most successful. And then all their friends are going to say, must be nice. Yeah. Motherfucker, it is nice. I created this nice thing for myself. No one was trying to help me when I needed help. As soon as you start to have success, everybody wants to be your friend, and they want to help you when you don't need it. But you remember the people who were there when you actually needed help and needed some guidance. And yeah, it's what I've been trying to do, is trying to influence and impact as many people as I can with the message without being a fucking corny, like, motivational goon. I know who I am. And if, you know, sharing the stories and sharing the experiences can help a few people, cool. And if not, there's always going to be haters. There's always going to be detractors. And typically those people that are spreading hate, they see something in you that reflects poorly on themselves. Like, oh, that guy's doing what I wish that I could do, so I'm going to talk shit about him. And, you know, that comes with the territory. It doesn't make it any easier to tolerate, but you have to understand the source of the...
vitriol.
Yeah, exactly.
You like that word?
That was pretty good.
I used to read the dictionary when I was in 10 block line. Practice words. Also, I think... You know, coming from where you came from and growing up and where you are, and I think a lot has to be said about who you associate with. Like, I found out, it seems so easy. You know, it took me until I was 43 years old when I first got sober, and I hung around a good friend, Spiro and Mickey Wood, and guys that were successful. And, you know, you'd always have the people saying, oh, he forgot where he came from. But
that's like the crabs in the bucket, man. When one crab starts to get out of the bucket, the other crabs drag him back in. They don't want to see you fucking get out of that bucket.
Yeah. And
that's human nature.
And you look back and it seems so simple, right? It took me so long just, you know, hitting the wall so many times and going back to prison and getting back on drugs and going to detox. But it's like hanging around with successful people, even if they're uber successful, you know a little bit's gonna rub off on you. You're gonna do better, you know. And you hang around, you know, in like AA and NA, there's the old saying, hang around a barbershop, you're gonna get a haircut sooner or later. Yep. Right? You hang around with people that are committing crimes, you're gonna be committing crimes again. You hang around people that are in the bar every day, you're gonna be drinking. You know, it goes on and on. Drugs, crime, whatever. Hang around people that are successful and positive energy and success driven, it's going to rub off. Maybe not as much as, you know, as them or whoever it is, but you can't, you know, measure yourself against them. You just, it seems so simple after a long time, like, do the right thing, good things happen. Hang around successful people, going to be successful.
Yeah, you know? People ask me a lot, like, how did you connect with the people and the friends that you have? And I'm like, that's where you have to get creative. Everyone is on their own journey. Like, you don't just ask to connect with people. Sometimes people will send me a message on Instagram like, hey, I need a mentor, or I need this or need that. I always think to myself, what's in it for the person that you're asking this? Like, hey, let's connect on LinkedIn. I understand why you want to connect with me, but why would I want to connect with you? Not to say that I'm something special, but if you want something from me and I don't know you, you should at least lead with, hey, I fucking work in banking and I have these relationships. Maybe we can help each other. I'd still say no, but yeah, the point is you have to be leading with a value proposition and trying to get in front of the right people by, in a lot of cases, working for free. I mean, the last real job I had before I worked for myself, I worked at an asset manager with huge asset manager, and I ran business development, but I had no experience doing that. I just knew the guy who was the founder and the chief investment officer was an avid cyclist. So I was training with them every week on our bikes, like 50 to 100 miles on Saturday and Sunday. And over the course of a year, basically convinced him to give me an opportunity to run business development for him. And he wasn't going to do it. I said, I'll work for free. And he was like, okay, done. And yeah. After a few weeks, it was so obvious that I was good at that job that he hired me on a full-time basis. And within 2 years, I realized I can raise money for any investment fund or any new business. And so that's what I've done for the last like several years, is worked as an independent banker or placement agent. So I raise money for hedge funds, private equity funds, as well as startups. And I've had some like huge successful raises, and it's changed my life. But the point is, I don't get to experience that change if I'm not willing to work for free and put my money where my mouth is. And keep in mind, I'm working for free. I'm living in Pacific Palisades. My rent is $12,000 a month. I've got 4 young children. Like, I have huge responsibilities. Like, we're burning through money. And I'm like, I'm either gonna sink or swim here. And I just made the conscious decision to like, nah, fuck this. I'm not going down without a fight. And like I always say to my children, like, yo, the game isn't over until you win. It's not over until you say it's over. And by the game, I don't mean an individual game. I mean the game of life. Like, we're all in this fight, in this struggle together. One of the things that my partner Teddy Atlas talks about on our podcast, The Fight with Teddy Atlas, is, you know, fighting is like a metaphor for life. We're all in a fight every day, whether it's, shit, I got to go in and ask for a raise today, I'm so nervous about this. Those are all normal emotions. The difference is, how do you process them and what do you do as a result of the emotions you're feeling, right? We all feel scared and anxious. And I tell my children that about this 51% mindset that I kind of came up with. And what it means is, like, when I was going to do the race in Mongolia, a friend of mine said, hey, I'm going to do this race in Mongolia across the Gobi Desert. And I was like, damn, dude, I don't know what made me say, but I said, I bet you I can win that race. Of course, he thought I was fucking crazy. And but the point is, if I don't think I can win, like, I'm not going to. The first step to doing anything is believing that you can do it. And so I started to develop this like mindset of like, yeah, I'm scared shitless to do this. I don't want to embarrass myself. I don't want to spend all the bread to go over to Mongolia. You know, there's a lot of risk involved, especially I had been winning races. People knew who I was in the running world. So there was a lot of apprehension and anxiety, but I only needed an extra 1% of my brain to believe I could do it, to drown out the other 49% of that like beta voice, and the alpha took over and was like, yo. And even through all my training, and I only had 4 weeks to get ready, I was super nervous, but the nervousness and the anxiety was motivating the training. But the minute I walked on the jetway to get on the plane to start the journey from, I went from Nashville to Atlanta to South Korea to Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, as soon as I walked onto the jetway, like, I could feel like a mental shift in my whole body that was just like, fuck this, we're going there to kill or be killed. And I went there with that attitude and that mentality. And you know, some people are there just to participate, just to have fun. To me, winning is fun. We can have fun when the race is over, but until the race is over, I'm willing to die to win this race. And you know, I've left many races in an ambulance because, you know, coming from the background I came from, I'm like, no one's going to punch me in the face or try to stab me during the race. I just have to like go fast. This ain't shit compared to like some of the struggles I'd been through as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, like you said, some people just go there to participate, but just to complete something like that, I mean, is a testament to you. You know, to that's insane. Just to complete a marathon is, you know, I mean, you see guys coming in when it's dark out. We'll be seeing it Monday night, right? We've seen on the news these guys coming in. You have some people like laughing at them, but you know what? They did more than fucking these people pointing out. Oh, look at this guy coming in 12 hours later.
The only
right?
people that would laugh about other people have like some real fucking deficiencies in their own life. Think about what you think about that. Same thing with leaving shitty comments on the internet. Imagine if I was like, hey, Ken, what are you doing? Oh, Mikey, listen, I just left a bunch of troll comments for people. I was shitting on people on the internet. You'd be like, what a fucking loser.
Yeah.
Like, who... Think about it. If you know people that's their gig, like, oh, I like talking shit to people who are in the arena trying to make noise. Like, come on, dude.
Like you said, it reflects on them. They look at other people and they say, I couldn't do that. And they shit on them. You know what I mean? People that, you know, just people that are, you know, just bad people, right?
Yeah.
People that don't accept responsibility for their own stuff, that blame other people, that are just negative in general, you know.
Professional victims.
Yeah, professional victims, you know. Those people are the fucking worst. Like I say that we've all had bad stuff happen. I had a bad childhood, but you know what? Compared to other people, people probably would have killed to have my childhood.
That's right.
So I could cry and go, "Oh, this happened and that," and then you'd hear stories about other kids that you know went through you know bad stuff, and you say, "Holy shit!" You know what I mean?
But you know,
mine
what?
Was a cakewalk.
Regardless of what happened to you, if you think something bad happened to you, okay. No one can deny your reality if that's how you feel. But the point is, fucking deal with it. I spent a week at a mental health retreat recently because there was a bunch of shit that was getting to me. And those when problems go unresolved, especially mental health issues, and you think you're just gonna suck it up and tough it out, dude, it's affecting every decision that you make when you have like trauma in your life and unresolved issues. So I went to this joint called On-Site Workshop, and it changed my life. It just gave me new insight into kind of some of the things that I hadn't really processed, for lack of a better term. And I know it's easy to be like, oh, this is bullshit. Just like suck it up. Okay. Some people can't suck it up and they become lifelong addicts. And I spent a lot of time wallowing in my addiction for reasons. I don't know why I was addicted. I just knew that it provided me with a fucking release of anxiety and darkness that I was feeling. And it took a while. It was one thing to get sober, but it was another thing to realize what was motivating me to get high. Because, you know, at some point, you're not getting high to get high. You're getting high to escape the reality of what you're feeling.
Yeah, because it's an underlying, what do they say, addiction's an underlying, whatever it is. It's something else, a root cause that why you're an addict.
Yeah, exactly.
It's something else, you know. So you went away for 1 week, huh?
Yeah.
Did they take your phone?
Yeah, man.
Oh, that's what I thought of right away. I don't know. You know what I mean? Can you do it? You could?
It was like going really? To... It was like going to the... I was driving there like I was going to the electric chair. Yeah. I was super anxious. But then I was also viewed it the same way I viewed the race in Mongolia. Like, no one ever goes and does something hard, a workout or anything, and regrets it. So I was like, you know what? I'm nervous, but I don't know what I'm nervous about. So at some point, I was just like, you know, took a leap of faith, went there, and... it was the best money I ever spent. Not only was it five or six days, it was also $10,000, so not covered by insurance. So it was a big commitment. So when you're spending the money and you're making that kind of commitment, you want to make sure you get the most out of it. So I like really did the work. It was just like going to rehab or something like that.
A lot of writing.
Like a process. A lot of writing.
Yeah.
A lot of talking.
Yeah.
No phones, no TVs, so there's no distractions. You're just locked in with a bunch of other people.
You know, when I was a kid, I was in... I was in DYS, and lately I've been thinking about, I got a friend who has a therapist. He's like, you should do it. Now I someone in my family is telling me, you know, you should talk to someone, and we should, and blah, blah, blah. So I've been actually looking into it, you know?
I talk to a therapist every week. Sometimes really? I'll talk to her twice a week. Of course. There's nothing fucking wrong with dealing with mental health. I'd rather talk about my mental health with a therapist than fucking use drugs and do something to try to escape. And people escape with anything. Fucking porn, gambling. It's not just drugs and alcohol. It's anything that's leading you to an unhealthy place. And the therapist, a lot of times... The majority of the time that I talk to my therapist, it's me just listening to myself talk. It's just a person to talk to about your feelings. You're not going to go and tell one of your buddies, let me tell you how I'm feeling. And they're like, oh, yeah. What the fuck are you telling me for?
Yeah.
The therapist is there to be a sounding board and help provide some clarity and insight, because it's easy to lose sight of what you're going through when it's happening to you. When you tell a third party and they're like listening from an outsider's perspective, an unbiased standpoint, they can then weigh in with, hey, have you thought about this? Have you tried this? Maybe it has something to do with this. And it works. I mean, there's a reason there's so many therapists and people talk to them, is because it works. It's just like AA or NA, how that can be a support mechanism for a lot of people and be, you know, instrumental in their sobriety. mental health therapist is, you know, is like my version of NA meetings.
Yeah, the person in my family, I don't want to, you know, talk about them, but who said we should, you know, go talk to somebody. I'm like, well, after they talk to me for a couple of days, they'll realize I don't have any problems, and they'll probably just want to focus on you, you know what I mean? Because I, but you know, to bounce off a couple of things about AA and NA, when I first, I got forced to go when I was 13, 14, I was right away, I was, you know, using drugs at a young age, this and that, and it was such a different thing then. Like, you went in meetings now and then, and people were sober, and they were, like, hardcore and this and that, and now it's, like, the age of MAT, which is medicated-assisted treatment, okay? Mm-hmm. So you go into meetings now, and they're not, there's not many, like, you know, before, that, not many just straight alcoholics anymore, like there was when I was mm-hmm. growing up in the early 80s and this and that. Now you go into meetings, and it's a lot different. You know, you get guys up there that are, and it works for some people, the methadone, your Suboxone, or this and that, but when somebody's up there and they're nodding out, and they're trying to tell me, you know, I've been sober, you know, this many years, and trying to tell me how to stay sober.
You ain't sober on methadone and Subutex. I thought that getting off of those drugs for me was harder than getting off the opioids.
Yeah.
Those drugs seem to stay in my system for fucking ages. But once I was hip to the Vivitrol drug, and I knew that existed, and
is not, in my eyes, that's not medicated assisted treatment.
No, Vivitrol, you don't get it.
It's just a blocker. If people don't know what Vivitrol is, you get a shot, and it's an opiate blocker where if you did opiate, you wouldn't feel it.
You can't get high.
But you could die, right? Because your body ain't feeling it.
I mean, you could die
you
if you overdose trying to get high, because it won't let you. It blocks the opioid receptors.
That's a different thing, yeah.
But you have to be sober for 7 to 10 days before you can get the Vivitrol shot, because it will send you into like rapid withdrawals if you.
So I know someone who did it straight getting high.
And they have to call an ambulance for them?
Yeah, Kid Fred Bo. He was
he was
violently ill. It was like hallucinate. Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
From what I hear,
fucked you up.
There.
I mean, they drug
tested. Bad scene.
The place I was at, they drug tested you before.
Because people are stupid enough.
It's like, dude, we're drug testing you. You're a junkie. We don't believe a fucking word you say. Like, no junkie is going to tell you the truth. That's the thing for people who haven't been addicted. They are like, you know, dealing with when sober, normal people are dealing with addicts, like, I can't believe he spent all the kids' college money. I'm like, what? Do you realize that the drugs take precedence over everything?
Over people with
themselves?
Their children. You see women with their children, you know, doing stuff. And it's addiction's a powerful thing. Going back to your little hiatus, you just went away. It brought me back to DYS when I was a kid. I was in 15. I was in a secure treatment, Westboro Secure, and they come up to me. It was a little before Christmas, and I had like 5 months left, and they said, we have this program on Cape Cod called, I think it was Homeward Bound or Outward Bound, and it was based off Outward Bound, I think. It was called Homeward Bound. So Outward Bound people pay to do this thing.
It
was Homeward Bound, and it was Brewster, Mass, on the Cape, Nickerson State Forest, and it was 26 days, and they said outdoor rigorous activity. And in DYS, you'd hear about people saying they break the ice and make you strip naked and dive in, which they did on Cape Cod, right? So you're hearing this, and it was crazy, but I mean, it's not like the ice on Cape Cod is like a lake. I mean, it's just you know, it's like a bay, so it was like thin, but the counselors would do it also, and that was the first day. It was like a 1 mile run, and I remember the last day was a 6 mile run, and it seemed like a mile. I was in such great shape. That's probably the last time I was in that good of shape. But at the end of the program, they had a thing called solo, and they take you way out in the woods, and the guy had skis, because he used to do cross country skiing, and he'd make this area like this big circle, and you had a tent, and they gave you like 5 hot dogs, like some kindling, like 20 stick matches, a cup of peanut butter, a cup of jelly, pieces of bread, right, and like carrots, and they leave you there 3 to 4 days, and you had this journal, and you had to write about, you know, like what got you there and this and that. And that's probably the last time it was called solo. At the end, you know, and they tell you, if, you know, we're watching you from binoculars. If you leave this circle, you know, and it's kind of scary being out there. You know, you're out in the forest in the middle of the night, right? And you know, you did that, and you know, at the time, you know, you're a young kid, you're not thinking, right? But I mean, that was probably the last time I did anything like really therapeutic. I've been in a million programs and I'm just not doing the work and this and that. But, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but just sitting there alone, you know, with your thoughts, you know, I mean, like I said, now I couldn't imagine being somewhere 5-6 days, no phone. I mean, I got my phone in my hand, as you know, 24/7, you know, with everything, with the social media and you know, the sober houses and the roofing business and everything.
How many sober houses now?
Two.
Both in Lowell?
Yeah.
And when you started the roofing company, were you working as a roofer? Like, how did you learn the trade to be able to price up jobs and then get the crews to go there? Like, how long did you work as a roofer to gain all those skills?
Never.
So you never worked as a roofer?
No, I never worked as a roofer.
Then what the fuck
scared of heights, Kenny?
What made you get into the business? Like, how did that start?
So after I was in rehab and Mickey took me down to Florida, I was down there a year and I was out to eat with this kid and he's like, you know, that's a business you want to get into. Look at that kid. They're power washing. There was like some Guatemalans power washing around a dumpster. He's like, all you need is a fucking $100 power washer from Home Depot and a pump sprayer and a gallon of bleach and a hose, kid, you know? So I'm like, so I started doing that when I first got back. And I tell the story in the winter of 2015 is when we get slammed with all that snow. And I already had a little Chevy S10 with a ladder, and I went down to the Patriots Super Bowl in Arizona, the Malcolm Butler thing, and I actually sold my tickets, and the price of tickets went through the roof. We sold them for $17,000, $8,500 a piece, and I was pretty much broke, you know, had like $1,000 to my name. And I went by the Wildcard Gym and saw Freddie Roach and saw Dickie's son works there, saw them, and when I came back is when we got hit with that snow. We didn't get hit till like the second week of February that year, and Lowell was the snowiest city in America. I still have the screenshot from the news, and roofs were collapsing everywhere, and I was at a gas station. A guy goes, hey, you shovel roofs? I said, yeah, I shovel roofs. And my daughter was like 7. I just got cussed there. She's like, what? And I'm like, shut up. Mm-hmm. He goes, how much you shovel that roof? And it was like a little cape. I go, 600. He goes, when can you do it? So I grabbed two kids. I go, hey, I'll give you 150 each to shovel this roof. One of them was a roofer. So they shovel it, and the guy pays me 600. And then he goes, hey, can you do my daughter's house? Can you do my neighbor's? So after like a month, I had like 38,000 from the ticket I sold, the 8,500, and shoveling all the roofs. And this kid working for me, like, he goes, when this shit thaws out, you know how many people are going to need roofs? I go, what do you mean? He goes, dude, they got idiots on these roofs. They're shoveling up against the grain, ripping shingles off. He goes, I'm looking at him. The house next to me, one guy was drilling through the ice dams with a drill.
Oh my.
He's like, this guy's drilling holes in the fucking roof. So we're not saying nothing. He goes, you know? He goes, when this thaws out, a lot of people are going to need roofs. And I was like, bing, like the light bulb going off, you know? So I went and bought a truck, a big truck with ladder racks and everything. And I got workman's comp and liability and started a roofing business. And that's how it took off. And I just kind of formulated, basically what I did is I'd find out how much the stock costs for a job.
Yep.
Like, let's say I'm doing your roof and I say, oh, the stock's going to, the shingles and the paper and this and that's going to cost $5,000. The dump's going to cost $1,000. I'm at $6,000. I'd usually just triple it and say, I can do your roof for $18,000, $17,000, you know? And I figured out after the labor and the stock and the dumping, you know, there was always room. I never really, you know, screwed myself.
Yeah.
So that it just kind of took off with that, you know.
That's a great story. That's one of my favorite things when people ask me about you and they're like, you know this guy Bean Shooter? He's fucking crazy. And I'm like, oh yeah, he seems crazy, but he's cool. And I never knew the story of how you got started. I knew you got sober and then started hustling, but yeah, it's funny. Speaking of the Super Bowl, I had tickets to the 2007 World Series. Someone gave them to me and my wife as a wedding gift. And the guy had season tickets in the front row behind the catcher. And as I'm going in, I saw, do you know Marky Moran, the tickets? He's
oh, yeah.
The ticket business. I see Marky outside and he's like, yo, you got tickets? I'm like, look at these fucking tickets. I have four of them. And he was like, I forget what it was, but like, I'll give you $40,000 each. And I think Ben Affleck might have wanted to.
With them at age ticket, I think.
And I was like, there's no amount of money, dude. I have to go to this game. Number one, they were a gift. But number two, I'm not fucking missing the World Series for the Red Sox. In 2018, when they beat the Dodgers to win the World Series,
I went to one of them games.
I took my oldest son to that game where they won the World Series. So the first game at 8 years old that he ever went to, he saw the Red Sox win the World Series.
It's all downhill.
Oh, they were sitting right behind Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Jimmy Kimmel. It was crazy. And we had our Red Sox hats on. And I was laughing because the people were super kind. I said, if you ever came to Fenway and were wearing the other team's hat during the World Series, yeah, they'd like light your hat on fire.
Yeah, it's like St. Louis fans. Yeah,
crazy. Yeah,
they're good.
But we had the best time ever. It was just, man, it was, we still look at the pictures together, me and my son. And my younger son is like a jiu-jitsu fighter and a wrestler. He's now 8, the oldest is 12. And the oldest boy, and then I have an adopted daughter from Ethiopia who's 13. But my youngest son is really into jiu-jitsu and wrestling, and Teddy Atlas trains him on the boxing. And someone had mentioned to Dana White that my son's really into it. Dana's been on our podcast. We've interviewed like every champion from the UFC. And and I saw Dana at the Nashville UFC show, and he's like, yo, I heard your son's really into fighting. I'm like, oh, he's convinced he's going to fight in the UFC. And he was like, you want to bring him to Boston next week? I'm like, hell yes.
Oh, yeah, I remember you. I didn't know you were there, and I didn't see you. That
we
was
had
bullshit,
the VIP seats, front row. We were sitting in front of Joe Mazzulla, Celtics coach. Mickey was there. Yeah. Johnny Damon came over, let my son put on his World Series ring, took pictures with him. It was just incredible. So right before the main event starts, Dana comes over and goes, Cameron, come here. Takes my phone, grabs Cameron, brings him around the octagon, interrupts the broadcast to take a picture of my son with Rogan and Daniel Cormier. Then he takes him over and has Bruce Buffer holding his hand up like he just won in the ring, and then goes, Cameron, get up there, get in the ring, in between, right before the main event. And he takes a picture of him standing in a boxing stance in the cage with a sold out crowd.
You can retire as a father. Dude, now
I was,
you're
like,
you're not gonna top that moment either. It's tough.
When I lived in London and in Hong Kong and stuff, like, I've been to everything, Wimbledon, the Monte Carlo Grand Prix. Like, I've done some cool events, and it's always novel. Like, I'm always like, oh, this is unbelievable. But sitting in the front row with my 8-year-old son, I was like on the verge of tears the whole night. And he was having the best time ever.
And with Sugar Sean winning in Boston with the Irish.
All those Nelk boys were sitting right behind us, dude, the Happy Dad guys.
That place was fucking electric. Were you guys there? It was an amazing night, huh? It was an amazing night. You know, that place fucking erupted, man.
Dude, it was crazy. And my son was just into it. He had on his Celtics jersey. He had on a leprechaun hat.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
and he had his Celtics jersey on. And when I bought him the jersey, I was like, what name do you want on the back? Tatum, blah, blah. He goes, Dad, I don't want another man's name on my back of my jersey. Can I get my own name on it? So we had him a shirt made up with our last name on it. He's just a cool little guy. And yeah, man, we had the best time ever. We're up to like 3 a.m. We had a flight at 6. We slept for like an hour and a half and then went right to the airport.
What's the time difference in Nashville? Is it one
hour behind central time? Yeah.
I only been there once. And I think when I was coming back from the Super Bowl in Atlanta, I think I was in Nashville for a night. Ran out of gas in Nashville, actually.
Yeah, man, I've been there 2 years. It's a great place. I got some cool friends. My friend, my buddy Jelly Roll, the country singer, lived across the street.
I see you guys together a lot. Yeah,
that's my man. Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. But that's the first time I didn't live in a major city. You know, like I said, I grew up here, then went to New York, London, Hong Kong, L.A., and now Nashville. What's a nice change of pace? A great place to raise the children.
Hong Kong must have been nice.
Oh, it was crazy. It was like a movie. You know, I lived in the had an apartment at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Kowloon, just across the bay, and I stayed there because the place was so high end, and I was working at a big finance job. Every time I would fly into Hong Kong, the hotel that had these long term apartments would pick me up in a helicopter and land on the roof.
No way.
Oh, dude, it was crazy. Yeah, I did the same thing in Dubai. First time I went to Dubai, I did some oil trades with some Arabs, and flew in from London, and they picked us up in a chopper, landed on that Burj Al Arab hotel, which at the time looked like a big sale. It was like the highest rated hotel in the world.
Shit, they're building there now.
And then they drove us back in a Rolls Royce Phantom. It was crazy.
Yeah. Like when you were saying about the World Series not selling the tickets, when I was down there, I was broke. And there was a thing with Ticketmaster where there was a shortage of tickets in StubHub where they sold all these people tickets. And they were predominantly Seattle fans. And they got down there. And since then, they changed their policy. It was if they didn't give you the tickets back then, it was a 200% return on your money. Mm-hmm. So, but the people were bullshit. They, you know, took a week from work, and they're going down there, and they're like, hey, yeah, sorry, there's no tickets. So I had two tickets actually from Mikey Catalano, we got in a big fight. He tried not giving them to me. And it was, you know, at the last second, I'm like screaming and yelling. And I ended up getting them because he knew the markup on them was ridiculous. And the morning of the game, it was on ESPN, the cheapest tickets going for $9,000. So we had nosebleeds. And I'm with my friend, and he's like, listen, he's a season ticket holder. And I was broke, you know? And he's like, hey, it's my birthday. The last time I went to a Super Bowl, my birthday, the Patriots won. It's a fucking omen. I'm going. And I'm like, listen, this is a straight business decision for me. Like, I got $1,500 to my name, right? And this guy looks at the tickets. He's outside. And he's like, yeah, I'll give you $17,000 for the pair. And there was section 420. I'll never forget it. There were nosebleeds.
Crazy.
And he bends down. I see him look at these other guys' tickets. And he's like, I forget what he said. I'll give you $50,000 a piece. So someone had good seats. And he bends down. He unzips this fucking, like, coach bag or whatever it was, bag of the thing. And it was just bricks of hundreds. And he counted out like 50 large or whatever it was. And I looked at my friend. I go, it's go time now. And I found out
he didn't roll him and take the whole bag.
Well, that guy was safe right there. You know, you're outside the stadium. It's gridlock. Yeah, yeah. You're not going to grab a bag and run. You'd make it 10 feet. You're going to get fucking tackled.
No, but someone would.
Yeah.
Let him try that shit outside of
that,
TV.
That guy knew. Come to find out, I talked to the guy afterwards. He was actually a ticket broker from Miami. He had like four or five guys with walkie-talkies, runners, you know, buying tickets off people and flipping them. I mean, who knows how much money that guy made that day. But when I sold them, I was glad I did, because I definitely would have walked out of that stadium when it was first and goal. You know, I know how I am. I'm not going to sit there with fucking a gazillion Seattle fans, right? Jumping up and down and screaming in my ear. Like, I'm like, I would have been in the parking lot. Like, what happened? You know? So I went to a bar with my friend, and he was drinking. And when it was first and goal, I left, and I'm outside, and I told the story. I'm in the rental car, and I look through the window, and I see Russell Wilson holding his, you know, had his hands on his head, and he's walking off the field. And I'm like, my immediate thought was they went for two and didn't get it, you know, because it was a foregone conclusion that they were going to score a fucking touchdown and win the Super Bowl. And so that was the beginning of the, you know, coming back, the snow, the roofing company and all that, you know. We sold
football
the tickets.
Games, what about the time you found the kid face down, bleeding from his face? Yeah. What was that story? I forget. I remember seeing it on your story. I'm like, what the fuck? Where'd this kid come from?
Yeah. So I go to the Patriots game with my friends, and they park like a fucking mile away, right? And they walk, and it was like this freezing rain. And I drive right to the stadium, right where the Putnam Club parking is. You know, you got to have the fucking pass to pull in. I go, just dummy up. I pull in. The guy just waves me right by. So I'm like, we're right in the Putnam Club. We pull up, right? So I go in the game. And now it's like the halftime just ended. It's the beginning of the third quarter, I think. What, even before then? And it was freezing cold. And it was like this rain. And I'm with these fucking nuts. They're all drinking and they're fucking blowing lines. I'm sober, right? I'm like, I'm not dying of pneumonia because I, you know, went to some stupid fucking game. So I left. And I'm walking through the parking lot, walking to my truck, and I was actually saying it on Snapchat, like, yeah, I'm going to sit in my truck nice and warm, listen to Zolak on 98.5, and I just heard this guy, like, moaning, and I looked over, and he was face down in a puddle, and his phone was right there, and his fingers were so cold, he told me afterwards, he goes, my phone was ringing, but my hands weren't working, and I pulled him up, and he chipped his tooth, his mouth was bleeding, his nose was bleeding, he fell face first in the parking lot, and I finally got him up, he could hardly move his legs, and I got him in my truck, I'm blasting the heat on him, and I defrosted him, Kenny, I thawed him out, you know, and his phone was ringing, so finally I answer his phone, and it's his friends, and they're like frantic, searching the whole fucking stadium for the guy. And I told him he was in my truck, and they ended up coming to get him. You know, I've never identified that guy. He was from Rhode Island. You know, usually I could put anyone on my story and someone would be like, that's, you know, Ken Rhino, that's, you know, that's my aunt. You know what I mean? If I can, you know, that was the one thing about the social media when I started just fucking around on Snapchat and stuff was I used to be, you know, clowning people sometimes, like, you know, look at this jerk off, you know, with a fucking ponytail. The guy's fucking 60, you know. And now I remember it happened like 2 years ago. It was just some guy in Home Depot and some girl messaged me. That's my dad, you know. And I'm just like, I was calling him Paulie Black's father. He's some guy with a fucking pot belly and a tank top. But yeah, so now I can't really. I got to be careful now because everybody sees someone. But that guy, no one ever called me and told me who he was. But another thing I wanted to touch on, Kenny, that you touched on a little, is you're a great father. You're a great role model. You're a great husband. You know, I know that for a fact. And I see you with your kids all the time, and you're a daughter, Tensei. What's your name?
Tensei.
Tensei. See that? Like,
yeah.
Tensei. Yeah, good. Yeah, man. She's the best. And you're a good guy, man. You know, you're
Thank you, dude. I'm trying.
You what you say, you do. You know what I mean? Yeah. What you see is what you get. There's no false pretenses about you. You know what I mean? And you're a real good speaker. Like when you talk about, you know, having drive and being motivated and everything, you know, the proof's in the pudding, like what you do, you know? And I think you got, you know, and I think other people think it too at Reebok and this and that, that you know, you got a career in that, you know, because you get motivated talking to you. Like,
thank you,
you know, it's like I said, I'll be eating something. I'm like, fucking Kenny's going to see this and call me a piece of shit. You know what I mean? So I'm always trying. I'm doing good and I'm doing bad. But Kenny, I know you're a busy guy. I know. This is crazy. I know you're a bit, probably the dog, right? We're talking, the dog stinks in it, right? Hey, so Kenny, I know you're a busy guy. I know you're doing some appearances. Why aren't you running the marathon? Yeah, it's Marathon Monday. We didn't even touch on the bombing and everything.
Yeah.
Why aren't you running the marathon this year?
I ran all the majors. So I ran in 17 months. I ran Boston, New York, Chicago, Tokyo, London, Berlin. I won four of them, got second in two for the over 50. Then I did the Mongolia race last year, and it beats the shit out of you, the training, marathon specific training. So I took this, like they have fall marathons and spring marathons. So the spring one this year, I took it off. I'm going to Kenya to do a race across the game preserve in Kenya in August, last weekend in August, first week of September. Another 5-day race, 150 miles, self-supported. I don't know, I just needed a break, man. I had done a shitload of races in a short period of time, and it takes a lot of energy to like get ready for that, to get to that like fine point. There's a much difference, there's a much bigger difference, a very big difference between being fit and being sharp. Like when you're sharp, it's like a fighter. You're like ready to fight.
Yeah.
But the guy, if you see like fighters, not when they're not in training camp, they're still in shape.
Yeah.
You need to be sharp. And but with regards to the kids, it's just the only example I had of how to be a parent as a child was what not to do. And you know, I just tried to give the kids the life that I wish that I had had as a when I was a kid myself. And it was just, you know, my parents were divorced, I lived with my mom, and like eventually a stepdad. Motherfucker is distracting the shit out of me over there with the fucking juggling and the throwing. Come on, brother. Come on, brother. But yeah, I'm doing my best to like set a good example for my kids and lead by example. But it ain't all like, you know, fucking rainbows and unicorns. When it's time to be firm and tough, you got to be firm and tough. And the kids take their direction from you on all things, right? So it's a fine line between being firm and being mean. But we're very firm with them. I think kids crave discipline. It's important that they have rules.
Yeah, that's what I gotta do. Step up the discipline game.
It's not just discipline, right? It's a fine line of like leading by example. You know, you're teaching them. I'm teaching them discipline through my daily activities, and they know that. Yo, my dad doesn't fuck around, man. Like, don't be screaming and yelling here. My dad's recording a podcast, or dad's on work calls. Like, you can come over here, but he's crazy.
Yeah.
And,
do they like, Tennessee?
Yeah, they like it. You know, they were little when we were in LA. Well, the little ones were babies, and now they're digging it. It's, definitely a different lifestyle, a little bit slower, you know. It's like, but they've got a school bus comes and picks them up, like the All-American, you know, All-American shit. In LA, my wife would have to drive them to all the different schools, and they were all, you know, because they're 8 to 13 now, so they were in three different schools at one point, preschool and elementary school, two different elementary schools, pain in the ass. But now it's, you know, now they're getting like little self-sufficient kids. The oldest, my daughter is 13, so we can leave them there and go out to dinner and like, you know, leave the older one in charge, so to speak. And, you know, it's like anything. You give them a little bit of, you give them little tests along the way. Hey, you guys can stay here while we go to dinner. Then we left them Saturday. We went to see the Nashville soccer team. You know, they got a professional soccer league, like MLS. Yeah, we went down there. It's funny because a lot of times I think I take some stuff for granted. I forget the magnitude, right? So we're at the game, and some of our neighbors invited us to a suite. So then I was like, oh, shit, you know what? My friend Walker Zimmerman isn't playing. He's the captain of the team. I'm like, let me see if he's in the stadium. Oh, he's going to come up here. And the people were like, the captain of the team is coming up to the suite. I'm like, yeah. they're like, I think to them it was like, Tom Brady's not injured, so he's going to swing by the suite and say hello.
Yeah,
but, you know, he's my buddy. And it's like, but I think that all of that stuff comes back to like setting the example. You want to be the kind of person that other people want to be around. Like, you know, I like to have fun and all that shit, but I'm not a fucking clown, right? Like, when it's time to get down, they know I'm going to be. Exactly. And I think that, you know, that doesn't mean you're locked in all the time, but when you demonstrate that ability to be locked in when it's time to be locked in, then you can kind of have fun. I always say, you pay me now, we'll pay me later. Pay your fucking dues right now and you can enjoy the rest of your life. But if you keep trying to avoid the hard work and the difficult decisions and the like uncomfortable conversations, they're just going to fester. It's just going to get worse. You got to deal with this shit now. It's like coming home from training. I'm like, okay, I got to get everything organized so I can sit down and relax. My wife's like, we'll clean it up later. We'll do it later. I'm like, no. I can't relax until I get... This is just my process.
Yeah, it's just who you are.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? But I wasn't always like that. I developed these habits and developed the discipline to be like, no, I'm not going to fucking not do the dishes after I use them because then they're going to pile up. Once I get them done, now I'm like, everything's done. I can chill. And, you know, when you have a lot of responsibilities during the day with work, training, kids, when it's time to shut it down at the end of the night, I don't like to have like other responsibilities hanging over my head.
One quick thing, we'll end with this. I know you're busy. How'd you meet Teddy Atlas?
Yeah, good question. My friend Rob Moore, who's a fucking crazy strong athlete, he won the Huntington Beach Marathon last year, ran 2:30. I met Rob in LA. We both moved from New York to LA at the same time, and we were training for the Ironman. So we were riding bikes together 4 or 5 hours a day every Saturday and Sunday. And he was a PR guy at Edelman, a big like institutional PR firm. He was like working with Samsung when their phones were blowing up. And
out of LA?
Yeah, he left his job. They're in New York, but he was out in LA. He left that job to do freelance PR work for brands at the same time I left the asset management company to raise money for people. And we were just helping each other with different relationships. And I told him, you should do some PR for some fighters. And he started working for a kid called Mike Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Mikey Lee, undefeated middleweight champ from Notre Dame. Really good guy, really good friend of mine. And Rob started working for him. Mike's dad was promoting some of his fights and put on an event and asked Teddy to be the commentator. And then so Teddy and Mike Lee's dad were buddies. And when ESPN stopped using Teddy so much, John Lee asked Rob to meet with Teddy and see if he could help him on the management side, just give him advice, maybe manage PR stuff. And Rob said, yo, you should have a podcast and get your voice out there. So like, they might not have you on ESPN, but at least if you have your own podcast, you can still have a voice and a platform.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, yo, would you consider doing this with Teddy? I'm like, are you crazy? I definitely would do that. And we did it and just slowly evolved into what it is now. We've got like over 300,000 subscribers. We've had some mega guest Teddy and I was Teddy's assistant trainer with for Alex Vozdik versus Adarbeev. We trained Vozdik.
Adarbeev's unbelievable. He's unbelievable. No one's ever gonna beat him.
I know.
No one's ever gonna beat him.
He's got a tough fight coming up with Bivol. That's for damn sure. That's a rumble.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's how I met him in
Staten Island. Stand up, Toad Hill.
Yep,
Teddy Atlas. That's it. You know, I tell people the story. I'm in. Mickey took me to rehab in Florida, and I was with a kid, P. Dub. I'm still friends with him now. He's from Staten Island. So he had the Teddy Atlas's book. So I read the book. And a lot of it was about Michael Mora trying to train him. And Michael was impossible. He's just like, no, I'm not doing road work today. And, you know, Teddy, he was driving Teddy crazy. And I read the whole book. And then, you know, I get out of rehab and I'm back with Mickey and we go to the Boxing Hall of Fame and I meet Michael Mora. So in the morning, he goes, hey, can I talk to you in the room? I says, yeah, what's up? He goes in the room. It was right before the parade. He had a suit on. He goes, hey, I just want to let you know, Dickie was downstairs in the lobby last night and all the fighters' family was down there. And he was saying you robbed the, you know, some banks back in Boston and this and that. And I go, oh, what the fuck, right? So I'm like, hey, listen, that was a long time ago. And he goes, hey, listen, I don't care when the fuck it was. I'm just letting you know your buddy was kind of speaking out of school. You know what I mean? So I goes, no, it's no big deal. So he's like, hey, if you've ever been to Florida, hit me up. So
and we'll rob a bank together.
I was actually going down to Florida once a month. I might or might not have still had a doctor down there who was prescribing me something for my pain. But I says, I'm going to be in Florida next month. And He's like, oh, give me a call. So I'm like, I don't know, call him. A week before, like 2 days before I went down, he calls me up. He goes, hey, you still coming? He goes, you need a ride from the airport? So I goes, well, this is kind of surreal. So he calls me up, and there was some fight on. I think it was Keith Thurman was fighting. He goes, hey, you want to come by my house, watch the fight? And he calls me up. I said, yeah. He goes, bring a couple pizzas. So like an hour later, I'm like, wow, a year and a half ago, I'm dope sick, homeless in the street, right?
Yeah.
And I'm in fucking rehab in Florida reading a book about this guy. Dude, and now I'm fucking sitting on his couch watching the fucking fights, fucking smashing a pizza.
That
I gotta say, you know, I keep talking about pizza. I'm gonna leave here and get a pizza. Santapio's, like we should have did last night. Shout out Mike at Santops.
That's gotta be the message to everyone watching or listening to the interview, is that, yo, the only person that can control what happens to you is you. None of us are victims. We're all in this thing together. But we're all responsible for ourselves. We're all born with one responsibility, the responsibility to take care of your own mental and physical health. If you don't do it, eventually someone else will do it for you. And I ain't looking to have someone care for me until it's the last minute. So, you know, if to anyone listening, like, you know, everything's how you take care of yourself is how you present yourself to the world. Walk into a room and make sure they know, oh, this guy's not fucking around. That guy's dialed. That's the biggest flex in the world. Money, watches, none of that matter. You show up in shape, it demonstrates to everyone that you have grit, determination, the ability to work hard towards delayed gratification. Those are things you can't buy. And but those are all things within your control, which is why those traits are so impressive. Anyway. Yeah. Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And I'll end with this. I had a counselor in the rehab in Florida, and she used to say something like that. She'd say, what legacy are you going to leave? You know, when you die. Oh, he was a good guy. He was funny. People liked him, but, you know, he didn't take care of his kids. Oh, he was in and out of prison his whole life. You know, he was a good guy, but he was a drug addict, you know? Like, what legacy are you going to leave, you know? And just something like simple as that, I think about it like, well, I'm a piece of shit. Like, I don't want to live like this
more. That's right. And you're not. Look at you. Fucking your own podcast, Bean Shooter 69. Let's go. Like a gentleman.
All right, man. Kenny, thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
It's like a bunch of narcotics.
There we are.
Pull up in a new Rari. Live it like you got it.
Come on.
Chopping bricks like karate.